Okay, so yeah, it's a great pleasure to be here and to be able to talk to you about some of the work that we're doing in my group. So I'm going to talk to you about open system quantum simulation, and I want to be very clear on the flavor of the quantum simulation I'm doing as opposed to the vast array of quantum simulation work that's going on. I now call this branch, and so it's just my own term, but I call this algorithmic quantum simulation. So in this work, I'm interested in the same kind of quantum simulation that everybody else is interested in, but it's kind of strict in the sense that in order to make clear statements, we construct explicitly the full algorithm, and then we cost it out. So by the time we're done constructing the algorithm, we're able to make statements about whether the quantum simulation is efficient or not. And in the stuff that I do, I always demand a tolerance, a well-defined error tolerance that is an input to the algorithm. So I'll go through this. I was hoping, and it's in the abstract, I was hoping to tell you about a full n-qubit open system quantum simulator, but there are some problems that we're still running into in terms of non-Markovian dynamics and sparseness. So that side is still a bit open. So I'm going to only tell you about simulating a single qubit, but I think even the single qubit open system simulation might sound a bit trivial, but it didn't turn out to be. So I'm going to tell you about that. So along the way, I'll mention results that relate to n qubits. But trying to get everything right for an open system turns out to be a bit tricky. Getting quantum algorithms to be rigorous and clear and costed, I think, is interesting for a number of applications. So ultimately, I think if we're going to deal with questions about cooling to a ground state or dissipative quantum computing or such other topics that are very important in quantum information at the moment, it's nice to be able to have the algorithms and understand them, how they would run on the quantum simulator. So I'll go through it. Most of the results here are just borrowed from various places in the literature. So it's a matter of just plucking the right results from different known results and putting them together. And the work is done Wang, and two visitors at various times, Marcos de Oliveira from Campinas in Brazil, and Dominic Berry from Macquarie University in Australia. And so the four of us are still putting this work together. So here's the outline of the talk. I'm going to start off by my favorite thing, which is trying to make the problem absolutely clear before proceeding. And then we'll get into the strategy. As many of you might guess, the strategy is basically dilation, Steinspring dilation. Open system, you can go to the church of the larger Hilbert space, have a bigger space, and deal with it as a unitary evolution. And then you have to be careful on what constitutes an error. So the error in the church of the larger Hilbert space has to be related to the error of the open system dynamic, which I'll talk about. I'll discuss decomposition. And one of the things I'll talk about, it's turned into a very hot topic recently. So if people know the Solovay-Kitaev theorem, then the Solovay-Kitaev theorem is a result related to taking a unitary operator and decomposing it into some efficient sequence of gates from a universal instruction set. And Dawson and Nielsen had an algorithm for doing so back in 2006, but the book is not closed on that. Even dealing with just the Solovay-Kitaev theorem still has some open questions, and we've done some work on this, and there have been a half a dozen papers, very nice papers, out in the last 6 months or so. So it's turned into a very hot topic. Suddenly everybody's thinking about how to actually write gate algorithms to deal with the Solovay-Kitaev theorem. And then I'll tell you about a channel decomposition, and finally end with the results. Okay, so this is the point that we have to make sure we understand what we're doing. So I want to make the problem clear, and I hope it's clear to everybody here. So what I'm hoping to do in this presentation is to convince you that we've constructed an efficient algorithm. By efficient algorithm here, I mean it's an efficient algorithm on a classical computer for designing an efficient quantum algorithm. And here, it's just a sequence of gates from an instruction set all done in a fault-tolerant way that is efficient. And by the word efficient, which I explained down here, it's done in terms of an error tolerance. So if you say that you want to simulate an open system, it can be described by, in our case, we'll assume it's a completely positive trace-observing map. We don't assume Markovian or any other thing like that. So given a completely positive trace-observing map, we want to simulate it such that the one that we do affect is no different than a distance epsilon, and I'll show you that the distance corresponds to the Schatten 1 norm, Schatten 1 to 1 norm. And so then in summary, what we want to do is to be able to take any completely positive trace preserving map that describes open system dynamics, ultimately on n qubits, but here I've signified that it's one qubit, and then and we want to make sure that both the classical and the quantum algorithm are efficient. In fact, this is in Dawson and Nielsen's work for when they're dealing with a single qubit for unitary dynamics. They construct an efficient classical algorithm for effecting an efficient quantum algorithm, modulo 1 oversight, which is the lookup table that I'll get to. Okay, so that's the idea. I hope it's clear then. The idea is simply to have an efficient classical algorithm that will design an efficient quantum circuit or quantum algorithm to be able to simulate any CPTP map on a single qubit. And then some of the lessons here are valuable in building up to more qubits. So the strategy I mentioned before, and this is that we're going to do a dilation. So we're going to do this Dynspring dilation given a mapping, a completely positive trace preserving map E. We're going to dilate it to a unitary on a larger space. We'll make use of the Soloway-Kitaev theorem and its constructive version in the Dawson-Nielsen approach. So that was published, anybody wants to know, quantum information and computation back in 2006. And then what has been overlooked, and this is the subject of papers recently, is to try to construct the lookup table. And I'll explain in cartoon form the Dawson-Nielsen approach and show you where we've managed to add to it. Constructing the lookup table naively actually turns into an inefficient process. So we have to find an efficient way to do that. And then what we'll do is take the CPTP map and we'll decompose it. And for those used to the affine, we'll simply make use of an affine representation of E and break it up into unitary poly and what we call amplitude, attenuation, and amplification channels, and we'll produce that circuit. And one thing I'll show you is that naively you'd expect to simulate one qubit, you would need three, and I'll show you that it's possible to do it with just two qubits. Okay, so this is just textbook stuff, but I want to make sure people follow. So I'm just putting up the operator sum decomposition to explain how we proceed with doing the dilation. So I just go through that quickly. Given a completely positive map, it can be, this is, represents trace class operators. So the state maps to some operator sum decomposition. The K's are often called the Krauss operators. And then if it's trace preserving, the sum of the K dagger K's is the identity. And then we just have a bigger space. We introduce an orthonormal basis I. And the orthonormal basis I is used to define the Krauss operators. And then by doing it this way, we're able to expand E into a unitary operator. So if the Hilbert space of the system has dimension D, then the Hilbert space of the environment has dimension at least D squared. So U is a unitary operator over a dimension that's at least E plus D squared. And then we say that this unitary evolution is minimal, provided that the dimension of the environment, Hilbert space, is exactly equal to D squared. So we work with doing a minimal dilation. The reason we care about a minimal dilation is that in experiments, qubits are expensive, and so we want to keep it as small as possible. And then, as I put down here, in general, for n qubits, 2n qubit and SIL are needed. So if you had a 1 qubit, you'd expect to need 2 qubits, but there's some shortcuts we found that reduce us down to 1 qubit in the system and 1 in the environment, and then we use a lot of random classical bits, which are cheap. Okay, now, question. No, so maybe I'm not using the best possible term. Okay, then that's worth noting. Okay, I didn't do it, but we're only so the approach we're using is compatible with what you said. No, I get your point. The point is that, in fact, you don't have to, the minimal dilation, you don't have to use the full d squared dimension. for the environment. You're saying you can reduce it down to one dimension if it's resettable. So, okay, I'll learn more about it from you later, but in fact, what we're doing uses that principle. Okay. So now I want to get into the definition of the error. So we want to say that if you do a quantum simulation, what is the error in it? If you take a quantum simulation of a unitary dynamic, the error is defined in terms of the operator norm. So a natural extension, and actually this is highlighted in a paper by Jens Isert and his group, who was in PhysRev Letters a couple years ago. They use the Shatten 1 norm, which I've defined up here, and we find exactly the same thing, that the Shatten 1 norm is the appropriate way to define the error. Now in the work that Jens Isert and his group did, they considered a Liouvillean dynamic and used the Shatten 1 norm. We're doing this dilation approach, and so we have a simple proposition here that points out that if we do a dilation to U1 and U2, so if we have two unitary operators on some space such that the norm of U1 and U2 is less than or equal to epsilon 2, then the Shatten norm between the respective completely positive trace-preserving maps is bounded by epsilon. So where this becomes important is that, and this is true for any number of qubits, if we're going to do a simulation of some completely positive trace-preserving map with respect to a dilation and a unitary operator being run on a quantum computer, then if we know the bound for that, then we imply the bound. So now we have at least we have an upper bound on the tolerance. And the operator norm is defined here, in case anybody forgets what that is. Okay, now the Solovay-Kitaev theorem that I mentioned, and this is, again, textbook material, for example, Nielsen and Chuang, it simply guarantees that for any n-qubit unitary evolution, doesn't have to be qubits, but any n-qubit unitary evolution, for example, that if you then construct a gate set, so an instructional gate set has the property that it generates by products a dense set in the set of all unitary operators in that group, then it guarantees that there exists a very short gate sequence. So very short refers to the fact that there's a polylogarithmic scaling. So given some error epsilon, there's a polylogarithmic scaling of the sequence, length of the sequence of gates with respect to 1 over epsilon, where epsilon's the error. And now I've tied the epsilon error to the epsilon of the unitary, of simulating the unitary evolution on the dilated state. Okay, and then we're going to pick the standard approach of the of three gates, the Hadamard, Pionate, or T-gate, and the controlled knot gate as our basic set. In experiments, these aren't typically the gate set that are used. In the beautiful talk this morning by Dave Wineland, and he mentioned Rainer Blatt's experiments that do what they call digital quantum simulation, they use essentially more gates. We have to be very careful here, because the wish is to use continuously parameterized gates. What we'd like to think about is that in an experiment, we have a tunable knob that can take on any value. But if we're going to be careful with the algorithms, we then have to identify a finite set of knob settings. So I'm going to take these, but if an experiment has a way of doing a fault-tolerant finite set, then it just means gate sequences are shorter. Okay, now I mentioned to you that we're going to use the Dawson-Nielsen approach, and there have been a number of papers recently. So here I'm just giving you the choices that are available in the decomposition, but we're going to stick with this blue one, which we abbreviate as the Solovay-Kitaev-Dawson-Nielsen algorithm. So there's a phase kickback algorithm that makes use of Toffoli gates, and there's various algorithms that have a lot of features. That came out by Austin Fowler in 2011. The rest of these you can see are the latter half 2012. Some are now appearing in various journals, and there are more papers coming out. But how to actually do this decomposition, you can see from the sequence of recent papers, is becoming very popular. We're just going to do this one because it illustrates the point, and it's known to be efficient. We know how to handle it. But there are discussions going on about how to count resources and which one's better than which. So here's the cartoon view of how the Solovay-Kitaev-Dawson-Nielsen algorithm works. So first of all, which they don't discuss in detail in the paper, there's a lookup table. And the lookup table would have a set of gates, and each gate is a SU2 transformation. It's got three parameterized values. And this represents, these arrows simply represent how the gate would transform some qubit by rotating it on the Bloch sphere. But each gate itself, SU2 has three parameters. The three parameters can be bounded between minus pi and pi. So it turns out that there's a way of regarding the SU2 transformations themselves as living inside a ball. And so here, I'm just representing the unitary operations. This is no longer the states, but rather the operator space. And then the idea of the Solovay-Kitaev theorem, which is really cute, the Dawson-Nielsen algorithm for it is really cute, is that given an operator U, then the idea is that you go to the lookup table, you find some gate that's somehow close to it. They require a set of gates such that no two gates have a distance in terms of operator norm of greater than 1 on 32. So here, they approximate it by this, and then they have what they call a balanced group commutator. So they take two unitary gates, V and W, and then they can look up, given that if they go backwards here and down here, they call that an operator delta, and then they can look up to find some sequence of V and W's that are constructed close to the identity so that they get that V, W, V dagger, W dagger operation, which I kind of think is a rectangular spiraling. So they go through, they get some approximate gate, then they have their lookup table, and they kind of spiral in until they have a gate that's close enough to the one that they actually want to construct. So that's the approach. That's their balanced group commutator. And it's a nice approach, proven to be efficient. They've got that in the Solovay-Kitaev theorem with that power C. They figured out what it is. I'll tell you eventually. And so what we did was to construct a table. We started doing this. We worked on this for quite a while and found that it was taking a long time. And then we discovered that naive lookups, so kind of constructing on the fly, turned out to be inefficient. And then what we figured out was instead we need a better approach. So this is different from the other papers that are coming out in the literature. We have a geometric search. And the geometric search is as follows. So remember what I told you, that the SU2 operators can be thought of as living in a ball. And then the idea of the Dawson-Nielsen algorithm is that no two operators in the lookup table can have a distance with respect to operator norm of greater than 1 on 32. So what we do is we fill up the ball with a set of boxes, and each box has a side length of 1 over 32 root 3, which means that the diagonal is 1 on 32. And so the idea is the lookup table needs to contain one unitary operator in each box that fills up the ball. Now, if you start doing the arithmetic, you'll see it gets a bit scary because the radius of the ball is going to be pi. So you have a number of boxes that fill up the ball. It's kind of like a volume. So it's 4/3 pi times 175 over 2 to the power of 3. And you get about 2.78 million. So the number of gates that live in the lookup table for the Dawson-Nielsen algorithm is around 2.8 million gates. And we actually started constructing it, and we found that, so then you can ask the question, what is the size of the gate of the shortest length in terms of the instruction set? Now, these are single qubit gates. So the single qubit gates that we allow are just the T and the Hadamard gate, and the answer is 36. So our lookup table comprises 2.8 million gates, each with 30. Up to 36 operations in a row. Scary in the sense that, you know, if we translate that to an experimental domain, we would kind of have to have these push buttons to be able to, you know, you push a button, and then you might have, like, you push this button, and it will affect a particular gate, which will be up to 36 operations. And then we have to run that Dawson-Nielsen. So it's kind of scary. At least we got that, and now it informs us on how to try to improve it. But it was very interesting getting it, because I kind of chatted with various people about what was expected, and nobody expected it to be that large. But the arithmetic is very clear. It's kind of elementary arithmetic. Okay, and then we have a few other subtleties that I don't want to go into, and that's that when we fill up a ball with boxes, some overlap, so we have to find ways to deal with boundaries. Okay, so now at least we filled in the lookup table for the Dawson-Nielsen approach. It is efficient, so it's big. But it's an efficient process, so we removed any question mark about that aspect. And then what we want to do is to now take the channel and decompose it. So whereas previous work talks about decomposing the unitary, we're going to decompose the channel. And the easiest way we found to do it is to make use of this affine representation. So every state row can be thought of as living inside the ball. A set of pure states are on the sphere that bounds the ball. And then if we do that, we're then able to write any CPTP map, any completely positive trace preserving map as a 4x4 matrix operating on these states represented as four vectors, where this matrix is built up in terms of the Pauli operators here. And this, so the effect is that that capital T, so if you think of the ball of states, so a block ball if you like, then the effect of this is to distort and the effect of this is to shift. So any CPTP map geometrically is just bending your ball in some way and then it's displacing it. And then the effect is that this CPTP map just maps the one point in the ball you care about to another point in the ball, and it's given by an affine map. This set of operations is obviously too large, so then there's a restriction, and the restriction on it being CPTP holds if and only if the Choi matrix is non-negative here. And then this just explains how to do it. If we use this rounded bracket to represent JL, so you could think of this like the qubit 0 and 1, and we take this operator, we replace it by a state in a larger, and basically taking the Banach space mapping to a Hilbert space, then this, if this holds, then the Choi matrix is non-negative, and therefore we can do it. So the point we're at now is that given any CPTP map on a single qubit, we just represent it in this affine representation, and then we verify that the Choi matrix is non-negative, and then given that, we now have an input. See, so this is an input to the algorithm. What is the CPTP map? So that works. Now we just need to decompose this affine representation. And so what we find is that we can decompose it into a Pauli channel and what we call a rotated amplitude attenuation amplification channel. So let me explain. The T, which is the distortion, can be implemented strictly as a Pauli channel. And a Pauli channel is just this. So sigma i's are the Pauli matrices. The sigma 0 is just the identity. So this represents the Pauli channel. And the ci's are then just some set of coefficients that are determined by the distortion. And then I'm just writing here some sort of a Pauli gate. I'll show you how to implement that in a moment. And then we implement the shift. Here, this is the little t. And this one we do by a rotated amplitude attenuation amplification channel. The reason there's the rotation in addition to the attenuation and amplification is simply the following. If I go back a slide, we have this vector, three vector, and we have a 3x3 matrix. So we're interested in the eigenvalues of the matrix and the basis transformation that diagonalizes it. So what happens is these rotation matrices are the correspond, it's a singular value decomposition. That's the easiest way to say it. So we do a singular value decomposition. These rotation matrices are just the unitary matrices corresponding to the singular value decomposition, and the attenuation or amplification is really transformation of the eigenvalues that corresponding to that T. You get it? So you do singular value decomposition on the 3x3 capital T, and then you convert it over to rotations and amplitude attenuation or amplification. And then we just have a clearly stated proposition. I don't go into the details here on why the number 12 appears, but it simply says that given any CPTP map on a single qubit, we're able to decompose it. Now this is exact, so it's not simulation yet, but we decompose it into some sandwich involving some unitary operators. This is the rotated amplitude amplification, whatever channel. This is the Pauli. So if you want to simulate the single qubit evolution, then you get the input. Then the first step of writing the circuit is to do the decomposition and write the circuit in this fashion. Okay, then the way that we implement it, and I think this probably connects with what Lorraine said earlier about, don't you just need one extra qubit? And so here's the way that we affect that transformation is if we do the amplitude attenuation channel, and here's amplitude amplification, we have a set of Krauss operators that we want to affect. We have this K0 and the K1, and the way we do it is simply add a qubit, do controlled knot operations, and apply rotation operators on it, and the alpha refers, the alpha comes out by the parameter of the affine transformation. Okay, then, so we do a controlled knot, then we do some rotation, controlled knot, opposite rotation, do a measurement, and then the result here is that that state has gone through an amplitude attenuation. we would put one extra bit in our simulation to decide which one to do. The only difference between the attenuation and the amplification is instead of controlled knots, if it's a zero, nothing happens, one, something happens. Here, zero, something happens, and one, nothing happens. This is obtained from this by just conjugating it with not or X operations. And so we would have a bit that would then control whether those are effected or not. And of course, like if you're going to simulate, I mean, you can think physically about this, where you might want to simulate like spontaneous emission of an atom. You know, it's a two-level system. Then what we do is convert between these. I kind of think of the amplification as what would emerge out of thermal. You know, if there's a hot temperature, this is like the spontaneous emission. So we have those two effects there, and then we're able to come up with we have those two circuits. Okay, so now we have the circuits to build up the attenuation and amplification. And so the resultant circuit is given by this. We have our amplitude, attenuation, amplification. We have the rotation. And it turns out that that requires just the 12 parameters. Okay, thanks. Now, I mentioned to you that once we get to this point, all we have is an exact decomposition of the CPTP map. So here, these tildes are meant to represent the approximation that takes place inside the quantum computer. So we have to be able to approximate every step. Every step along the way would be done in our approach by the Solovay-Kitaev Dawson-Nielsen algorithm with our lookup table. And then the answer can be kind of obvious once we get to that point and then build that up. And the answer is that we wind up with the same scaling that Dawson and Nielsen had. So the C and the Solovay-Kitaev power, Dawson and Nielsen filled in their 2006 paper. So the idea is that the quantum circuit has order log to the power 3.97 of 1 and epsilon gates. And the runtime on a classical computer to devise it is actually shorter. It's log to the 2.71. The reason why a classical algorithm can simulate a quantum circuit in faster is because there's a lot of redundancy in the code. And so by taking advantage of some compression to avoid the redundancy, this is actually quicker. So all we've got, by doing this full decomposition, we now have a complexity for the single qubit open system simulation that would match the single qubit closed system one, which is what we expected in the first place. But it was just nice to go through and construct all that. OK, so I'll finish by just telling you what I already told you. And that's that, so first of all, we now have a clear picture of the CPTP channel simulation error. We've simply connected that with the error of the unitary operator that's obtained through a Steinsprung dilation. We have developed an exact decomposition of the arbitrary single qubit CPTP channel as a product of these operators. Again, each of these things, like I said, is kind of drawn from the literature, so there's no amazing leap in any single step. It's just a matter of putting known things together. But we have that derivation. We do have the simplification, so instead of dealing with 3 qubits, we're down to 2 qubits, which is recyclable. That's the reset that Lorenzo mentioned, plus the classical bits. And along the way, it was kind of fun that, you know, because we're filling in every piece, and the missing piece about the lookup table turned out to be one of the harder parts of this. So the part that we took for granted actually took us a few months to put together, and that's the lookup table here. And then finally, the result is what we expect, that we now have our single qubit simulator, poly log 1 and epsilon. And then as I promised at the beginning, I mean, the idea here is to try to take this to the full, which is what I'd hoped to report here. And let me be clear again where the problem is, that if we take an arbitrary CPTP map satisfying that Choi matrix condition, then, and we want to be able to do a decomposition, we probably want a condition like the dilation. So if we dilate the CPTP map to a unitary operator on a larger space, we probably want a condition such that it would be generated by some Hamiltonian that would satisfy the Aharonov and Tashma sparse Hamiltonian lemma. That's my intuition on it. And we're not able to make big progress in that direction yet. We do find that we have made progress in that direction, but only in cases that we later find reduced to the relatively easy case of Markovian dynamics. And we're trying to get it to work for non-Markovian. So at this point, I'm just reporting what we got on the single qubit. and then how to deal with the multi-qubit case is still open. It's a nice thing being at this workshop, because maybe somebody here actually knows how to do it and will tell me. And then that will save me a lot of time. But that's the idea. And then ultimately, I think it's important that if we're going to investigate problems I mentioned at the beginning, like cooling to ground states, dissipative quantum computing, dissipative generation of entanglement, all kinds, non-equilibrium quantum phase transitions, et cetera, one way to tackle and understand these problems is to have the quantum algorithms on this not yet created quantum computer to be able to analyze it. And so that's what this is a foundation for. Thank you.
So there is one question there, Ali.
So if you want to simulate instead of a single channel, just a time evolution, do we need a different circuit for different time instances, or you just...
So let's see if I understand. You said to simulate for different time evolution, is that what you said?
Well, see, I mean, the channel is just evolution over one time interval, right? But if you want to simulate the evolution over time, do we need a different circuit for different times, or...?
Yeah, okay, yeah. No, it's a very good question, and it's correct. So what I said is an input to this algorithm is the CPTP map. Of course, a special case of a CPTP map is a unitary evolution. So if you reduce to the case that all we're doing is simulating the unitary evolution, then that would correspond to an e to the minus iht if the Hamiltonian is time independent, where t is in the input. So the implication of making a circuit that would simulate a CPTP evolution is precisely what you said, that if you were going to simulate a dynamic, that becomes an input, and then the circuit would be different for every time of evolution. That's correct.
John?
Regarding what you said about the n-qubit case, it's maybe I didn't understand the formulation of the problem. If you have a general CPTP map on n qubits, there's no reason to expect, after you dilate the channel, that the Hamiltonian will be sparse. In fact, I could consider just the unitary case, right? If I consider a general unitary, there's no efficient circuit. So I wasn't quite sure what the formulation is under which you expect to get a sparse unitary, a sparse Hamiltonian.
Okay, so that's good. So the way I take your question is kind of reformulating what I probably didn't express very well. I don't expect for an arbitrary CPTP to dilate to a unitary that's generated by a sparse Hamiltonian either. What I would like, so in what I showed you, the CPTP map can be checked against the Choi matrix. So I think of it algorithmically like an accept-reject condition. Suppose that you fed into it. You said, here is a CPTP map, feed it in as an input, then the algorithm would perform a check on the Choi matrix and say, yes, we can, or no, we can't. So I would like something which said, given a CPTP map on n qubits, it would then have an accept-reject condition. And as you're intimating, it will reject most of the time. But that's, in order to write that simulator, you get the point now, right? That what I'd like is an algorithm that will provide a simulation where it can be done, and will reject, will say, I can't do it in the case it can't. Is that?
Are there other questions?
Yeah, I'm also a little confused about one of the last statement which I have missed. Did you say something about Markovian versus non-Markovian here near the end? I mean, in my view, as long as we have a quantum operation and this is a discrete time, evolution is only an end time process. And indeed, just back to Ali's question, I imagine you thought about Lindblad dynamics. But for that, we know already that there is an infinite, we need infinitely many building blocks, even for one qubit, so that's kind of the bad side. But in any case, where do you put the, or to put it simply, can you elaborate on the Markovian versus non-Markovian issue that you have alluded to?
So the idea of the quantum simulator for n qubits in the Markovian case, this is in that, I don't know if you know the Fizeroff letter by Jens Eisert a couple of years ago. They take they don't do it quite algorithmically, but essentially they're assuming something like that there's a master equation that's written in a Lindbladian form, sort of plus. It's continuous time and it's Markovian. But then going back to Ali Reza's question, the point, what I'm saying, like the point I think Ali Reza was making is that we don't have, in this case, T is an input. So, come over here, you can see. So then the idea is, like, we're not trying to do something with the continuous time.
Right.
So time is an input in this case. Then I don't think we run into the problem of an infinite number of steps.
Then it's non-Markovian in the most general, or
yes, this allows it allows any CPTP map on a single qubit.
Yeah.
Therefore, it allows any non-Markovian case.
Right. That's,
well, because we have the Choi matrix condition. So, your point, Gershon, I think, is that if we had, he's loud enough. if we said that, can we write a simulator that will simulate for any time t for any non-Markovian system, then we don't have a guarantee of CP. But in the algorithm that I'm presenting to you, it's for CP. So the Choi matrix condition checks that that holds. So if what you're suggesting, and this would be correct, that it is not a simulator for any non-Markovian evolution, it's only a simulator in the non-Markovian case where the CP condition holds. I like the restriction, but pardon me? Oh, that's right, but that's why I'm saying building block, right? So this is, I'm not answering everything, I'm just trying to build up to the point we can do some interesting things.
Any more questions? So if not, it means we are going to have a longer coffee break until 4. So thanks again.